to say it. Somebody should. Let's talk about tool time. Let's talk about bull wine, yeah. You're asking the questions that nobody could. Like where the bone thugs in, are they in harmony? Do, do, help a snowman, do.
All right, everybody. Well, today, this could be the dawn of a new era of Helpful Snowman, or it could just kind of be the dawn of a very temporary era that, you know, we go away from immediately. It's maybe an era's tour, and it may be a era's tour, but done by a much smaller act than Taylor Swift. Me, basically. An era's tour where I book one show where I had to pay for the venue myself and debut songs that I wrote after deciding to go on a tour. If I had to do an era's tour, I think what it would end up having to be is I would be like, okay, I'm going to write a song that's like what I cared about during different times in my life. You know what I mean? Be like, well, rollerblading song, I guess, or a song for the roller rink. That's an era. Beating Captain America and the Avengers in the arcade, which took usually about $5 worth of quarters, which I did many times. And I can't say I regret it. You know, I think a lot of people would look back and be like, oh, if I only had that money now. But I mean, how much could it have been total? I didn't beat it 20 times. But even if I had beat it 20 times, it'd be $100. $100 is not enough to change my life at this point, you know. I'm very, privileged in that way. I don't know if I'd say I'm very privileged. I would say I'm normal-ish amount, just in that one specific thing. Just, you know, $100. Don't get me wrong. Someone wanted to hand me $100. I wouldn't be like, that's meaningless to me. But, you know, if someone wanted to go to patreon.com/helpfulsnowman, probably, and give me money, I'm not going to turn you away. You'll see that. You'll see that I have no problem coming on hands and knees for that stuff. But, I don't know. Those memories of playing Captain America and the Avengers are probably some of my fonder childhood memories. Not in the world of Captain America, you know, wasn't tainted by my anxieties and so on. So it was for a worried, anxious child, it was a good place to be, just punching stuff, moving from left to right, occasionally a level where you were flying or under the water, which I always wanted to be Iron Man during, because I was like, this doesn't make sense. And Captain America had to get on this dumb little car, which I was like, well, what's the point of that? He's on this dumb little car. Couldn't anyone do that then? Why does he need a super soldier serum to pilot some little flying vehicle? I argue no. I may argue incorrectly no, but I argue no. So, the new thing that I'm going to try is based on, I read a book called Joke Farming, How to Write Comedy and Other Nonsense by Elliot Kalin. And in it, Elliot Kalin talks a little bit about podcasting. He is the host of a podcast called The Flophouse, which is very fun. And he said two things about this podcast, although not actually about this podcast, but pertaining to this podcast. One was that he never really listens to or could really imagine listening to a podcast done by a solo host, which I felt very seen by. And by seen, I meant hurt. Because to me, that's what seen means. That's the only kind of feeling seen that I think I've ever experienced, which is like, ow, my pride. I don't know that I've ever, you know, felt like something happened and I was like, yes, finally, someone's saying what I'm thinking. It's more like, for me, being seen is like, yeah, I can see you over there being a fucking weirdo, you know, sitting, staying as close to the wall as possible at the party, in the high school party in the movie. where it's like the wildest party you've ever seen in your life. If I had a kid and they threw a party, I would be mad. However, if we had like a Nest Cam or something and I could see it, and I was like, holy shit, like this is like one of those high school parties where they like put a pizza on the record player and, you know, we're playing the pizza like a record and doing keg stands and like jumping in the pool and, you know, I don't know, all that kind of shit. And then maybe Freddy Krueger shows up and starts killing everybody after he explodes out of some kid. If it was a party like that, I would be like, as I am angry. And I'm going to make you do a whole bunch of work to, like, put the house back in order. However, my anger has been tempered because, to be honest, it would be unreasonable for me to expect that given the opportunity to have that kind of party, you would turn it down. That just doesn't seem like a reasonable position for an adult to take. Anyway, so, you know, he's not real hot on solo podcasts. So, I mean, I guess I'm already, I know he's not going to listen to this. So it doesn't matter. I could trash this book, I guess. The other thing he was saying is that for podcasts, it can be helpful if you talk about something, like if you have a core thing that you're kind of going along, because then you have some idea of how close the podcast is to over. You know what I mean? You don't know. Maybe this is like a 2-hour show. Maybe this is not. If it just kind of rambles on with no beginning, middle, and end, you don't know. Like on the Flophouse, they talk about movies. So you kind of have some idea when they're talking about the movie as they approach the denouement, you know, how far along in the podcast you are, right? So I said, okay, I'll do a bad movie podcast. And then I realized I did that for 31 days for Potoween and kind of, it was torturous, but also like that might be the kind of podcast there's the most of. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it just beats out Chat Show where people just do whatever, wink. But I think if there's like a sort of, if that can be called a genre, that might be one of the heftiest genres, right? Because it's easy. I mean, we've all seen fucking movies, right? So we can all watch a movie and then be like, that movie is bad. So then I pivoted and I was like, what if I did books? Because I read books. I like books. I'm trying to read more books. But also because I was like, that kind of gives some structure to the whole thing. But also because I was like, I don't think as many people read books. I'm not saying there are no book podcasts out there. I'm sure there are many, right? But there aren't going to be many like this, which is mostly I'm going to use a book as a very loose framework on which to hang jokes, a scaffolding, if you will. If, you know, if you're someone who lives in New York City or visited New York City ever, and you're like, how is 90% of this city sidewalk covered with scaffolding? Like, you go to Manhattan and you're just like, does this scaffolding ever, do they ever take it down? Or is it like once they put scaffolding in front of a building, they're like, yeah, fuck it, just leave it there, we'll make more. Some guy owns a bunch of scaffolding companies and has got a deal where he's just like, just leave it there, buy new, you know, I'll make it worth your while. Anyway, I'm sure there are many, many book podcasts that are very, you know, studious and talk about the literary qualities of books. And I don't think I'm going to do that so much as just use these as wild ways to talk about whatever the fuck I feel like talking about. Now, this is a little bit like one of my heroes, Dave Carney, who wrote for a magazine called Big Brother, which kind of turned into Jackass. How a magazine turned into Jackass is an explicable story, but it's not one that I'm going to explic because it's not that exciting. But Dave Carney wrote a lot of things for that magazine, and among them, he would do things like CD reviews, you know, album reviews. And it would be like a review of, I don't know, fucking U2's new album. And sometimes he would talk about the album, but most times he would just talk about whatever. It would just be a little paragraph of whatever, whatever was on his mind. Sometimes wouldn't even mention the CD. Sometimes wouldn't even mention music in general. So I think that's kind of where this is headed. So we're going to experiment with this for just a little while and see how it goes. So first things first, I got this book from the University of Chicago Press. Now, I tried to get it from them directly, I should say. I didn't get it from them. I tried to. However, what happened was I went to the website. I put it in my fucking shopping cart. And then they should really need to change it to a reusable shopping bag, right? But I put it in the shopping bag and then I went to go buy it. And what I found to my dismay was that I had to create an account. And so I was like, fuck that. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not doing that. Because, you know, I'm not making an account to buy one book, which is funny because it's like, okay, well, I bought it on Amazon ultimately, but I already have an account there. That's the thing. That bell has been rung. There's no going back. There's no, at this point, it's impossible for Amazon to not know who I am. I think they've got me pretty locked down. Now, in some ways they don't, because I've bought some weird shit for like parties and stuff that doesn't really make any sense. It's kind of for me, I feel like sometimes what I do is almost like, it's like I advocate an anti-Fight Club, you know, maximalism, where I'm like, yeah, you know what you should do is go ahead and buy stuff from like Amazon or whatever. And then just every once in a while, buy some fucking really weird something. You know what I mean? Something that doesn't make any sense. And that way, you know, you'll kind of beat the system. Or like if you're on Facebook or something, just fucking put out, you know, a weird post every so often, or like something that doesn't make any sense. Just put out a complete garbage post that doesn't even make sense, that kind of prompts people to message you and be like, have you been hacked or something? This is really weird. And you're like, why, you know, why would you text me that? Or why would you message me that on Facebook? If I've been hacked, wouldn't I just be like, nope, I sure haven't. this is not a hacker, by the way. So, but yeah, so I was like, fuck you, University of Chicago Press. Like, why do I have to make an account? I'm never going to buy something from you again. I mean, I know what you guys are up to. You know, you're like, whoa, go down there to Taste. Right along Lakeshore Drive, maybe take a little drive out there and get a pierogi. Then we'll publish some books, make some literature. Get to all I know what you want to do. You just want to send me your catalogs every whatever. And they have a seasonal catalog, which I have up here. Let's just see what I might be interested in. The first book that kicks off the catalog is Talking Classics, The Shock of the Old by Mary Beard. Here's the description. The incomparable Mary Beard is back and she's talking all things classics. Yes, we all know the incomparable Mary Beard. Should I just look that up? Who is Mary Beard? Mary Beard is a classicist. We know her from SPQR, A History of Ancient Rome. I feel like I've seen that, but I don't know. But yeah, who fucking cares? I don't care. I don't know. I could compare Mary Beard to somebody, I'm sure. I don't know if incomparable is... It's a good word to use if you have to blurb a book. And then you're like, what the fuck do I say about this person? The Incredible Afterlives of Dr. Stevenson, One Scientist's Epic Quest for Evidence of Reincarnation, Apparitions, Poltergeists, and Other Matters of the Soul. By Jesse Baring. The untold story of an iconoclastic scientist, a psychiatrist who dedicated his career to documenting consciousness after death. I mean, it's probably a bunch of horse shit, though, right? I don't know, man. Oh, Shell Day. A story of 24 hours and 24 Molluscan lives by Helen Scales. An hourly guide that follows 24 mollusks to reveal the fascinating lives behind their shells. That's the kind of book that, like, sometimes I aspire to read because I'm like, I want to know things about, you know, stuff that lives in a shell. But then sometimes I'm like, yeah, like, I'm just never going to, right? Or like Fire and Clay, How Bricks Reveal the Hidden History of Chicago by Will Quam. A remarkable exploration of Chicago's architectural history through the humble brick. Like, there's a part of me, Poonmaster Flex went to this thing. It was like a lecture where she works, and it was by a guy who just everyone knows is the bug guy. And the bug guy talks about bugs, and he's very into bugs. And, you know, she's telling me about it, and I do understand there's a certain... There's a certain thing that, like, when someone's really into something, even though I'm not into it, sometimes their into it can be powerful enough. You know what I mean? They can have so much desire for it that it's like, okay, you know, or like so much interest in it. I mean, I think it takes a certain combo of somebody who's like a little self-aware, you know what I mean? And they kind of know what people are into and what's interesting, but they also kind of, you know, are a fucking huge nerd. And I think that's the thing, is it's just like, when you get somebody like that, sometimes you're like, you know what? I can listen to this guy talk for 90 minutes, like, and I will be entertained. I will enjoy what's happening here. But I don't know, man. A whole book about bricks, and that's going to take me like 5 or 6 hours to read, probably. Also, a book about bricks better have a lot of goddamn pictures, because I am not going to know what you're talking about. I mean, it has to be a picture book, right? Here's a Human Babylonian Reflections on Labor by Sophus Hella. Acclaimed author and translator Sophus Hella considers an ancient creation story with themes of humanity, class warfare, and catastrophic climate change. Well, there you go. You know, it's just like, yeah, or, okay, here's a good one. How to Read Hegel Now by Shannon Hoff, a powerful exploration of how Hegel's ideas about freedom can speak to social injustice today. I just don't care about that. I cannot read Ludwig Wittgenstein's Remarks on Mathematics and Logic, Volume 4. Don't, University of Chicago Press, don't send me a pamphlet. Don't send me an email about that. This is the Chicago way. You put one of yours in our shopping basket, we put two of yours in your email inbox. Anyway, that's the thrilling tale of how I got the book. Isn't this new format going great? I like to imagine someone who's actually interested in this book is like listening to this, or like actually interested in my opinion on the book is listening to this and is just like, what, when the fuck is this guy going to talk about the book? The answer is now, asshole. Okay. Calm down. So the book is basically about writing jokes. And I'll just tell you right now, in case you haven't figured this out at this point, I don't think this book has actually made me funnier. You know, and I wouldn't expect anything that I write or say into a microphone to be any funnier. So just, you know, manage your expectations, please. That being said, it has, I think, some good writing advice in general. A couple things that I think are especially good, but I think the overall tone of it is kind of about going from being a sort of writing when the mood strikes, or, you know, maybe being someone who people are like, ooh, you're funny, to becoming somebody who like can write jokes kind of on demand. Cause that's what you, he was Elliot Kalin, the author, was like a head writer for The Daily Show, among many other things. And so like, if you're doing, I don't know what they do, like 6 days a week, something like that. It's like, you got to put together a fucking full length show a few times a week. You can't kind of just wait for inspiration to strike. And there's also an element of, you can't just sort of, write jokes about whatever, because, you know, certain things are happening. So you have to make jokes that fit in with those things that are happening in the world. Right. So he talks about joke writing and how it has, you kind of have to make it a process. You kind of have to be a little bit more like a factory worker instead of an artisan in some ways, and like emphasizes the importance of that practice. And I do agree with that to a large extent. I mean, it is a lot like what I think a lot of sort of writing advice kind of things say, which is like, the writers I know that make it aren't necessarily the most talented. They're the ones that, you know, don't give up and they just keep writing stuff and eventually it works out for them. I am the exception that proves that rule. Yeah, every rule needs an exception, and I'm proud to be that. At the risk of sharing too much of this book, I want to just kind of, he outlines his process, which is like 8 steps, and I'm just going to read it. You know, this is like page 19 of the book, so it's not like I'm giving you too much. I remember in library school, not in library school, after library school, I went to a copyright seminar to learn about copyright, because that's the kind of exciting doors that a career in libraries opens for you. It's basically, it's fun. I really don't recommend going to a copyright seminar if you work in a library or whatever, because here's what'll happen. You go, and then you get a lot of questions from people because they're like, oh, well, now he knows a lot about copyright, which was, you know, true-ish. I wouldn't say I was like an expert, but I had a pretty good idea. And basically, you get to tell people no all the time. And then they'll argue with you on various, you know, to various degrees. As far as like, well, what, why not, you know, or, hey, it's not like anyone's going to know that I used this Star Wars art to make a poster for my event. And I'm like, that is true. However, like, let's just be honest with each other. We both know, you know, you asked me a question and I gave you an answer and you didn't like the answer. So, yeah, what can you do? What can you do now? You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't change the answer because I'm like, oh, I didn't realize you wouldn't like that answer. Well, in that case, here's the answer I'll give you instead. You know what I mean? So it just, it gives you a lot of opportunities to say no to a lot of people in a lot of different contexts, in a lot of new ways. You know what I mean? Like, it really does give you a chance to, have people dislike you for telling them things that, you know, they probably kind of already knew were true, but were hoping that you would say it was okay. And it's like, look, what do you want me to do, man? You just want me to say okay so that that way you can just do the thing you wanted to do. And then if anything happens, you're like, well, he told me it was fine. Anyway, in that class I was in, I learned it was really interesting because a lot of people have this false notion that that basically if you copy something, like if I put a portion of a book in my own book or something like that, that there's a magical percentage that you're allowed to share. And there's just not, right? Like that's not how it works. Because you can share a part of a book that, you know, you could share a huge portion of a book. So, for example, a thing they used in the class was there's a guy who wrote a parody of Gone with the Wind, and it used very large portions of the original text. However, they were like, well, it's actually, it's okay to do this because, you know, his changes to it were transformative enough. And I don't think, you know, another factor favoring fair use is like, will people buy this instead of the original in very basic terms? And it's like, yeah, I don't think anyone's going to buy a parody of Gone with the Wind because they're like, well, I'll have Gone with the Wind and the parody. I'll have so much value for my dollar there. So anyway, but the other example that I thought was really interesting was the president who pardoned Nixon wrote a memoir, and a magazine basically published the section where he talked about why he pardoned Nixon, which was like the thing that everybody was really interested in. So then the magazine got sued because they were like, hey, no one wants to buy this goddamn book now because you know, this is all anyone really cared about. And now no one cares about it. So, and they won the case because they were like, this had like a major financial impact on the book. And like, even though it was a tiny percent of the book, it was a huge percent of the, you know, value of the book was kind of erased by publishing it in this magazine. So I think this is a small percent of the book. It's also like on page 19, and I don't think you could really, you know, me telling you this is not going to be like, aha, well, now I don't need the book anymore. So here we go. This is the process. One, identify the absurdity I've recognized in a subject, the seed of what's funny about it. Then consider how this absurdity would be viewed from the perspective and frame of reference of the comedic voice for which I'm writing. So, you know, that's obviously like, well, if it's you, then hopefully you know what your comedic voice is. And if it's me, it's probably rambly and in a podcast and calling its audience assholes. Two, state that absurdity in plain language in order to clarify the purpose of the joke. In other words, the point I hope the audience will take away from it. Three, select a humorous way to communicate that purpose, the conceptual premise that will lead the audience towards seeing the point. Four, apply a concrete structure to that premise in a first draft. Joke structures tap into familiar patterns that help to bring out the humor of the premise. Five, think oppositely to find a twist in the structure that yields another even funnier layer to the joke. I know, structure gets 2 points in the process. It's that important, though it still only gets one chapter to itself. Six, finesse the joke's tone, making sure its emotional attitude gives the audience the proper cues for how to feel about it. Seven, put a final polish on the wording with an eye toward brevity, clarity, and specificity, as well as capturing the voice of whoever's telling the joke. And eight, deliver the joke for an audience that laughs so hard you become instantly rich and famous. Results may vary. So that's kind of like the very basic process. And, you know, he very much goes into detail. This is a shockingly academic book. I guess I should say it's shocking because I don't know that I expected it to go so in depth into like kind of what jokes is. And it definitely does. It's dense. It's like, this is not like a, you know, a beach read, I guess. I mean, he puts lots of jokes in it, you know, which I really enjoyed. And like, I enjoyed reading it. But I am, you know, kind of the nerd that would like this. Poonmaster Flex makes fun of me sometimes. And then I make fun of myself because sometimes I'll tell her a joke and then way over explain the joke. You know what I mean? I'm like, how can I just drive this into the ground? And the way I've even thought of before, I think it would be very funny to write a joke book that then, you know, it has the joke and they're very short. And then the following pages are a super in-depth explanation of the joke. You know what I mean? Like way overdo it. And just anyone reading it be like, Jesus Christ, okay. Like, kill every joke. And I just think that would be very funny. Although I think I would be the only one who found that funny. You know what I mean? That seems unreasonable, unreadable, right? Like, how could you possibly read that? How could you possibly get through that and be like, oh yeah, yeah, that was fun to read, you know? It seems like kind of a one-note joke. It is a one-note joke. So, like, I don't know. It's like a thing that, you know, maybe I'll just have to do because it's in my brain. And it's like, well, a thing's in my brain and it won't go away until I get it out of my brain. And that's just the curse that I live with. You know what I mean? That's how I make sense of the world, is writing things down. So it's like, well, I guess I'll write this down for no one but me. I think there's a really good story in here that kind of illustrates the process, or, you know, an element of the process that I think is very easy to follow. So this is called The Story of the Fox. Once upon a time, when my wife and I were first dating, we loved a particular expensive curio shop in the Park Slope neighborhood of Brooklyn, RIP Cog and Pearl. One of the objects on display was a small red stuffed toy fox about 4 inches long that was so beautifully made that the stuffing inside really mimicked the natural musculature of a real fox. It had a sort of smug look on its face, like it was patiently waiting for you to realize something important that it had already known for a long time. I really wanted to own this fox, despite it being ridiculously expensive for a small, smug, stuffed fox. My then-girlfriend, now wife, bought it for me because we were still at the stage of our relationship where you buy stupidly overpriced stuff for each other for no particular reason. That is a thing that happens, right? Like, you're at a certain point in a relationship and you're like, but this doesn't seem expensive to me because I love this person so much. And it's like you kind of go insane a little bit of like, I would never fucking buy this. Maybe it's something too, like there's something to buying something for someone else that's dumb. Like when you spend money on a dumb thing for you, it sometimes feels bad. But when I spend dumb money on something that's dumb for Poon Master Flex that she actually does want or would like, that feels great. Cause I'm like, she would never do that for herself. So when I do it, it's amazing. Let's see. I decided to keep the fox on my desk to justify the expense by making it somehow work-related, and I came to find that the fox had a strange mystical hold on me. Not in a scary, you must kill anyone who would come between us way, but in a productive, let me help you unlock imaginary doors way. I found that when I was stuck on an idea that wasn't working, I could look at it and be reminded to think like a fox and find a novel, clever way to approach the material. I would do this by imagining the exact opposite of my original idea. What if, that smug little face seemed to whisper, instead of doing this, you did that? That usually didn't work any better than this, but those two poles would establish the boundaries of imagination that I was working within, creating a continuum along which a new, more surprising, and funnier thought could be found. Whenever I find myself writing something that feels predictable, I visualize the fox to remind myself that surprising elements can be discovered by imagining the opposite. You obviously don't need a stupidly expensive stuffed toy fox to do this. You may already have, or you can easily create, your own way of tricking your brain into jumping its rails and reaching something unexpected. TV and film writer Ruth Flippin described a non-fox approach when she said, "When you're in trouble with a script and a scene won't work, try writing it backward. Or take the lines the girl is saying and give them to the boy. For that matter, take an old joke and switch it." But that's not systematic enough for me. I'll say about the fox method the same thing I'll say about my joke farming process. You don't have to do it this way. It's not the only way to get there, but this is my way of doing it, and for me, it works. See, I mean, the book's overall, you know, it's called joke farming because the idea is you're doing farming. You farm jokes, which means you have to like plant seeds and tend to them and like kind of constantly be working on it as opposed to running out when you need it. It's weird. I actually made a training for work to train people how to do social media and used an analogy of a garden, which is like you have to kind of stick with it and do it every day because you can't just plant a seed and then go out in October and be like, now I will harvest my pumpkin. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't work that way. And so if you kind of plant a seed expecting to just be able to go out there whenever you need some food, it's probably not going to work great. So, similar thing in a much more boring uninteresting, stupid work related thing. I can't believe I'm talking about work. I hate talking about work. So, I mean, overall, I think this is a great book. I did enjoy it quite a bit. And it does give some good advice, but you know, there was also, I will say there was, an element of, you know, I was robbed of some of the joy of it because during the time which I read this book, I had a thrombosed hemorrhoid, which I teased in the last episode. And, so I was taking baths and stuff to try and reduce that. For people who don't know what a thrombosed hemorrhoid is, I will try to explain it. Basically, it's a hemorrhoid, which is blood vessels in or around your butthole. And when it's thrombosed, what it means is like basically it pops out and then blood goes into it. And then that blood clots and basically creates a pebble of sorts. And so it's like you have a pebble under the skin in the most sensitive, one of the most sensitive areas of your body. I've been made to understand that your butthole has like more nerves than just about any other part of your body, which I'm like, why? Why did we do that? God, can you explain this to me? Like this, I don't need to feel much going around in my butthole. Let me back up a little. How did this happen? You may be wondering. How did a healthy individual like you end up in this position? And, you know, I wondered the same thing to an extent. Because when you look at the advice for not getting or managing hemorrhoids, I mean, a lot of it's like drink lots of water and get exercise and do these things. And I'm like, I do like 90% of the things you're supposed to do. You know what I mean? And there's like get fiber in your diet, but maybe not get fiber, or maybe get some, but not too much. And, you know, how will you know? What ended up happening is before I talked about how I had gotten food poisoning and I was pretty sick for like 2 weeks. And then at the end of that 2 weeks, I hadn't drank any coffee for those 2 weeks. And I've always kind of wondered if coffee may be related to my bowel problems, but I don't know. So I was like, well, you know, I've gone through the first 2 weeks of coffee withdrawal after drinking it daily or twice daily for like 20 years. So maybe I should like just keep riding this train, right? And so I ended up being incredibly constipated. Now, sometimes I think it's like people are constipated in a way of like, yeah, I kind of had to go. I was bloated, whatever, and so on and so forth. This was like crippling pain. I went into work foolishly and then had to go home because I was like, this is not going to work. So I'm not sure. I may have ended up constipated because I just cold turkey stopped drinking coffee, although it took like 2 weeks. So I don't really think that's what happened. It also may have been I'm like recovering from food poisoning and like, I was very dehydrated, you know, so I know that can be a problem too. One way or another, I ended up super constipated. And so I sat on the toilet for probably like a half hour one night, and that was enough. So then that was enough to, I think, cause the hemorrhoid initially, right? So the next day I'm super constipated and I have this very painful hemorrhoid. So what would happen is like, when you're constipated, it's like you kind of have to go, but you kind of don't, or like whatever. And my butthole would clench. But when my butthole clenched, it was pretty painful. And so I spent the whole day like this. And like, I mean, going down the stairs was incredibly uncomfortable. You know what I mean? It sort of felt like I was going to shit my pants, while at the same time, shitting my pants seemed like not a bad idea. If you've ever been, here's how I think a good way to know if you've ever been really constipated. When you start thinking things like, yeah, I would just shit in the bathtub or something like that, you know, or you're like, you know what, if this just starts coming and it's like, it feels like it's going to happen and I'm sitting in my car with pants on, fully dressed, I will just shit my pants. because that would be preferable. You know what I mean? I'll shit my pants now and live in the relief very briefly before then having to clean up on aisle five, because that it's worth it, right? So I went through this for most of the day, and I was like, this is like, it was wildly uncomfortable. It was very reminiscent of stabbing pains I've had around my butthole for many years. Very on and off, though. It'll happen a couple times a year. So I started, you know, doing consulting with Dr. Google and being like, do you need to, by the way, the show will end with me giving joke farming some kind of rating. So, you know, just so you know, we're not done with joke farming. Okay. So then, I started Dr. Googling and Redditing and being like, do people go to like urgent care for constipation? You know what I mean? I was like, is that a thing? Cause I'm not a person who's been constipated maybe twice in my entire life. It's not very common for me. So I was like, this is kind of new for me. I'm not really sure. And, you know, I found a Reddit thread where it was basically ER people complaining that people come into the ER because they're constipated. And they're like, they haven't even tried anything over the counter and so on. And I was like, all right, I'll do that. So like I make my way to the grocery store and I just feel like, I know I look probably the same, but I just feel like I feel like the way that my driver's ed instructor looked. He was a bus driver and he was like this huge fat guy and just very looked very bloated. His face is always red, you know what I mean? And he just looks like he's completely stuffed inside of his skin. And that's kind of how I felt. And I'm like walking in and there's a guy out front of the grocery store with like a petition, you know, and he's like, oh, hey, are you a voter? And I was just like, I can't do that right now. And he's like, okay, you know, to his credit. So anyway, I go look and I look at the laxatives and there are basically two varieties. One is like a pill and one is a suppository. And I look at the pills and they're like, well, these work in usually about 6 to 12 hours. And the suppositories were like, works in minutes. And I was like, yeah, that's what I'm getting. Because fuck that. You know what I mean? I'd been experiencing extreme discomfort for something like 12 hours. So I was like, yeah, I'm done with this. So I get it and I take it home and I insert it. And then I started a timer because I was just like, you know, that way I can look at something and be like, okay, you know, it says it could take up to 15 minutes. So, you know, give it that amount of time and before you whatever. I'm not kidding. It was within 4 minutes. I was like, oh, this is happening. I took like one of the giantest shits of my life. I mean, but, you know, it wasn't good in that it definitely, if it hadn't already been for sure caused, this was for sure the moment the hemorrhoid thrombosed. I mean, I was shitting hard and like legs shaking, you know what I mean? Just like crazy. And then almost immediately felt much, much better. You know what I mean? I was like, that was insane. That was like the hardest I've ever shit in my life. And I feel so much better. You know what I mean? I was like, thank God. Here we are. Not realizing that I had caused this damage to my butthole, which would rear its ugly head like a week later. It's like a week later, and I have, you know, some what I think is hemorrhoid action going on, which isn't brand new to me. This has happened to me before. But starting Friday night and going into Saturday, the pain became very extreme. And it hurt constantly. Like there was no position I could be in that was not pretty painful. And especially if I moved around or did anything, you'd be surprised, like, your butthole wants to clench, like, when you go down the steps. You know, every step you go down, your butthole wants to clench. Or, like, when you roll over in bed, it's like your butthole kind of wants to clench. And this would be, like, burning pain. And I was like, what the fuck is going on, you know? And I could feel around back there and was like, okay, there's something's going on back here. So, you know, I Dr. Googled it again and decided to call the like on-call doctor or whatever for my general family medicine person. And she was like, yeah, so you should probably, she's like, you could go to an urgent care or you could try and come in on Monday. And what they'll do is a procedure called a thrombectomy, I think. She's like, because probably what you have is this thrombosed hemorrhoid, right? And she's like, we can, I just now imagined like somebody who's like, I don't know, somebody who knows Elliot Kalin and is like, oh, there's a podcast about your book. And then listens to this and is like, this person's just telling me a lot of stuff about my butthole. Welcome to Helpful Snowman. This is what happens here. I'm sorry. I'm sorry that this book had to be associated with this, but it connects up in a moment. So this doctor was like, you could probably come in on Monday or I could call around or you could call around to the urgent cares and see, because if there's like a GP at the urgent care, they'll probably do it for you. But if there's not, they probably won't. And I was like, all right, you know, and I was like, I don't know. I guess I could wait till tomorrow or whatever. There must have been something in my voice, though. Because she was like, well, why don't I call around and see if there's someone at an urgent care who's willing to do it? And so, you know, hero of the day, she does this, calls me back and is like, there's a guy at this urgent care, so go for it. So we drive over there and, you know, I go in and get on a table and this guy is like, this doctor is like, all right, let me take a look. And he's like, yeah, you definitely, that's a thrombosed hemorrhoid. And he's like, so here's what we're going to do. I'm going to make basically, I'm going to inject you with sort of an anesthetic. A needle. That's going to hurt. Then what I'm going to do is cut it like an elliptical hole in your hemorrhoid and then get the clot out. And he's like, so what's going to happen is, you are going to hate me for about 20 seconds. You're going to hate me more than you've hated anything in the world. And then you should feel quite a bit of relief, though. And I was like, all right. And, you know, when the lady was telling me to go to the urgent care, she was kind of describing this procedure. And she's like, I know it sounds scary or whatever. And I was like, listen, I've been in enough pain for the last like 48 hours that I'm like, I don't care. You know what I mean? If they were like, we are going to put a shotgun in your butthole and pull the trigger and that's the cure for this, I'd be like, great. Okay. That sounds fine. Should I bring earplugs or will you provide them? You know what I mean? That's the place you were at. They have that saying, right? Like when the cure is, when the disease is worse than the cure or something. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, definitely the pain was worse than the cure. So, wasn't thrilled when the guy, so he comes back in with a nurse because, it's a two-man operation because one person has to hold your butt cheeks open while the other does the procedure. Wasn't thrilled that the doctor, reached into the XL glove box. You know what I mean? I'm like, oh, that's not great. But then, so he injected me with the needle, which hurt, but wasn't that bad. And then he cut me and which I didn't feel at all, but then he kind of had to express the clot and the blood out. And that is that's up in the top 10 pains of my life. Top five for sure. Top five. Yeah. I mean, as far as like intense pain, it felt like he was shoving his fist into my ass. And also his fist was covered in broken glass. Like it was really painful. And he was 100% correct that like as soon as he was done, I felt great. I mean, like we were driving home and Poonmaster Flex was like, I didn't realize I think how much pain you were in. Like you're like a completely different person right now. And I was like, yeah, I feel amazing. So anyway, I had this done and then the doctor was like, well, I'm going to refer you to a surgeon because, you know, he's like, I can't really investigate what all you've got going on other than this right now, but someone should probably take a look. And I was like, whatever, man. Because at that point, I was like, I feel amazing. And he's like, here's what you need to do. You need to take baths like 3 times a day, just like a warm, you could take a sitz bath or just sit in a regular bath. A sitz bath is like a bowl that you put on the toilet and fill up with warm water, and then you sitz in it. And then you need to do preparation H suppositories twice a day for 10 days. And I was like, great, no problem. It's funny because like they always talk to you like, you know, he's not going to want to do suppositories. And I'm like, again, I am like, whatever, whatever you tell me to do to make this not happen, I'm up for it. So I did. I went home, started to not feel as good after about an hour, you know, as the anesthetic wore off, and felt actually pretty terrible for another couple of days because, I had a hole cut in my butthole. You know what I mean? I had a small incision in my butthole. And of course, that doesn't feel great. And then from there, it's been like a couple of weeks of slowly recovering. I mean, it's amazingly slow. Like, it happened so fast, and the recovery is so slow. And so I read a big chunk of joke farming when I was sitting in the bathtub, because sitting in the bathtub is a good time to read normally, because it's like it's relaxing and there's not much to do. And like you could watch something or whatever, but I'm like, you know, I don't want to bring my, if I bring my phone into the bathtub, I will drop it 100%. There's no way I'm not dropping it in the bathtub. And then everyone's going to be like, well, why did you have your phone in the bathtub? And then I'll have to be like, I had a thrombosed hemorrhoid that I had removed. And so I needed to take baths to recover from it. And, you know, that's why I was in the bathtub in the first place. And then they'd be like, I don't think I needed to know all that. And then I'd probably be like, yeah, I don't know if you did, but you asked. And what did you want me to do? Concoct some fake story to protect your feelings? Fuck you. If you ask me, I'll just tell you the story. So I read a big portion of this in the bathtub while trying to recover. So in fairness, my mind was wandering quite a bit. You know what I mean? It was hard for me to focus. I was still in some pain, still not feeling myself. I am still today nowhere near feeling myself. So just to kind of tally that up for everybody. Yeah, and it's beginning of March, and in 2026, I had food poisoning that took me like 2 weeks to get better from. And then about a week later, horribly constipated. And then about a week after that, thrombosed hemorrhoid, which I had removed. And now it's 2 weeks out from that. And I'm just now starting to feel kind of pretty normal, like getting there. And I just want to go to bed though every night at like 6 o'clock, like just be in bed and maybe fall asleep at like 9, because I just don't want to be in the world. You know what I mean? I don't want the world to exist. That's the place I'm at. And Poon Master Flex is like, you know, are you depressed? Are you like still recovering or whatever? And I was like, oh, I think both. Yeah. I don't think we need to do the dirty work of dividing that into two different things. I think it's definitely both. So things are going pretty bad over here. Joke farming. How to write comedy and other nonsense by Elliot Kalin. Is that enough structure for you, Elliot Kalin? Did you feel like you knew when the story was going to end? And when I circled back around to the book and talked about how I read it with, farting blood into the bathtub, farting dried scab blood flakes into the bathtub. Is that what we all wanted to hear? Is any of this what anyone wanted to hear? If I was a smarter man, I would make this into like an empowering thing. You know, I'd be like, people, you know, get your butthole checked out and like get your colonoscopies and do that, you know, like whatever. I'm manly and I did it. You could do it too or something, but that's just not me. I'm like, whatever. I'm not that guy. I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I came out of that. I'm the opposite of, you know, people are like, they feel molded by the difficult things they've gone through. And I'm like, no, I feel molded by the difficult things I've gone through, and that each time I go through something difficult, I come out a little worse. You know what I mean? A little less happy and a little less physically able and just kind of worse every time. But that's not the experience you'll have if you read Joke Farming, How to Write Comedy and Other Nonsense by Elliot Kalin. You will feel better because it's not a difficult experience. He peppers in many jokes and makes it very palatable. So I think it's the opposite of, you know, going through a tough thing and coming out better. It's going through an enjoyable experience and coming out better, why would we go through a tough thing to come out better when you could just have an enjoyable time and come out better? That seems like a very obvious better way to do it. You fucking dummies. All you motivational dummies out there. All right. Well, there you go. That's our discussion of Joke Farming, How to Write Comedy and Other Nonsense by Elliot Kalin, with a divergence into my life. Stay tuned for our next episode, where we'll talk about another book, and I'll tell you about the people who over the last couple weeks have had their fingers up my butt and what their advice has been. It's not earth shattering, but I'm on quite a trip this year. All right. We'll see you next time. Somebody should talk about two times. Talk about Budweiser.